Hinumathawe, greetings everybody. I'm Dr. Ted Hohola, and welcome to Season 2 of our Place Knowing podcast series. We're building on the stories we shared in Season 1 about how and why we engage Indigenous design and planning methods to heal damaged lands and waters called brownfields. This season, we turn our attention to the 2015 Gold King mine spill disaster, where a crew from the Environmental Protection Agency ruptured a plug of rock and soil near Silverton, Colorado. That incident released 3 million gallons of acidic mine waste into the Animas River on the northeastern edge of Navajo Nation and still impacts farmland and sacred waters in the San Juan River Basin. In the coming episodes, you'll hear how Indigenous and non-Indigenous scientists, farmers, and community members are coming together through cultural resiliency to restore and protect their places. We begin with Diné research scientist and farmer Brandon Francis, whose family has stewarded corn in the Black Mesa, New Mexico area for generations. Brandon works with New Mexico State University's Agricultural Science Center in Farmington, New Mexico, and takes the time to set both the cultural and scientific tone for the rest of this series. Brandon and his organization were key in providing much-needed information about the status of the spill as it was unfolding, and critical testing for farmers on the health of land and water in the aftermath of the spill.
Every decision that you make as a researcher and as a scientist, you have to analyze it in terms of how is this going to benefit people, and not just you. It's not going to advance your career as an Indigenous person. You're trying to move along the five-fingered people, the people who live on the surface, the human people.
A big thank you to the Transformation Network for sponsoring this season, and to our production partners at the Antes Dandelion. And don't forget to find us and follow us on your favorite podcasting platform. Matuwan. So shall we jump into it then?
Before we start, like Kevin, I read his work before I met him. And then same with you. I read a lot and heard a lot of what you've done. So it's an honor to finally get to meet you in person.
Hey, thank you. I'm really glad that you appreciate what it is that we've been working on, because, you know, the whole notion of seven generations planning and Indigenous planning and all of that has been so fundamental to certainly our profession.
Yeah, when I heard you were part of the Transformation Network, and I was like, yes, someday I get to meet him in person.
And here we go. Awesome. Thank you very much. Really, I'm honored that you said that. So can you please introduce yourself?
Brandon William Francis. I always introduce my name first. And when I was in my traditional introducing my clans, because like I mentioned, that's how we show them where we're from and our clans and who our mothers were, who our grandparents were, who our father's father was, who our mother's father was, and just honoring them. And wherever we go, we always say that we're never alone. We're always, like you said, we always have family. And my mom, she's a big fan of every time I go out and present. And she saw my introduction one time. She's all, "You don't introduce your name first." Because when you're a baby and you're born, when we introduce you to the world, we say, we introduce you as a clan member. So that way, when you go through life, you'll never view things as individualistic. You'll always be doing things for your people, for your clan, you know. And I always thought, oh, wow, I never thought about things like that. And it's just different ways of introducing myself. I know that people will introduce themselves, but that's just a way of showing my respect for my mother and my original first clan, Nat'o'tenet'hutchini, is a Hopi adopted clan. And I mentioned I was from Black Mesa. So that close kinship with people living on Black Mesa, it's a huge demographic area. People think of it as like a set like community, but it's actually like 11 to 18 different communities of Navajo, just Navajo communities. And then there's the Kisani or the Hopi people that we live in close proximity to. And over time, married into. So my clan is Tobacco People of the Red Running Into the Water clan. And that's a whole another long story. But I always like to introduce my clans and to my children who are Edgewater, and showing them that that people who are Edgewater Clan, they're also my children. So
speaking of matrilineal, your mom had an incredible influence in your life and your vision and what it is that you're doing, right? Can you say something about that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I always give her props. And I wish I could say that I was the first person to go to college in my family. But that path was bravely beaten by my mom and my uncles. And every time I'm giving the presentation, and she always finds a way to find a transcript or watch it, and she always tells people, "He's living my dream." And because when she went to school, it was the family dream to save the family farm, because she was going to study agriculture and her cousin was going to study animal husbandry, and they were going to revive our ranch, our sheep camp, where I was born and raised.
Oh, wow.
But when she got to college, she realized that our language was more in danger than our agricultural past. And so she realized that helping children at a young age was that crucial age of, and now our language, you can learn it on Rosetta Stone, which is something that's very beautiful, and that's preservation. And so that every time she sees me working in agriculture and helping people with the knowledge that my grandparents and my relatives passed on to me, she's always saying, "Oh, you're living my dream." And I always honor her in that way and saying, sometimes we have to do things, you know, that to preserve our knowledge, our language for future generations, and sometimes put aside things. But yeah, I'm very grateful for my mother.
So you describe yourself as a seed keeper, right?
I have never described myself as that, but people describe me as that. I always describe myself as a corn planter. And in Navajo way, we always say, when you tell people that you're a corn planter, it signifies something very significant. And I learned this from my mentor, the late Dr. Larry Emerson, who instilled a lot of knowledge and respect for professions, like holy professions, like planting food, growing food is a holy profession. And so when you tell people you're a corn planter, and you tell, it's signifying that you have respect for life, no matter how small, no matter how big, and it's a holy profession. And I do save seeds, because when I was first planting, starting out planting, I was given seeds that we've been growing on Black Mesa for thousands, hundreds of years, and instilled it into my method that I teach people. And whenever someone asks for seeds, I don't charge them. I just say, only thing I ask is, if you grow some, give me some kernels, an ear back, a few seeds, and that way we can keep the genetic diversity in those plants. But I do people, when I'm people, especially at the Old Fort in Hesperus, where I gain a lot of knowledge, they always say, "Oh, you're a seed keeper. You're a knowledge keeper." I'm like, I never thought of it that way. But as you probably know, we view plants in particular as our relatives. So when you're a seed keeper, you're taking care of your relatives. And in that way, it's very sacred.
So that, in a sense, also is so integral to how it is that the Diné people, especially in the San Juan Basin, developed their unique lifestyle, right? Can you describe that relationship a little bit?
I can describe it. Being from Black Mesa, I grew up dry farming. And for the longest time, I was telling people, "I'm a dry land farmer." And I didn't know there was a difference between a dry land farmer and a dry farmer. A dry land farmer is anybody that grows in dry conditions. And you can have irrigation on it. But people who grow in are dry farmers, and the Pueblo people are good examples of this, they don't have a reliable irrigation system. So they rely on the resiliency and the epigenetics of their seeds and the love that their ancestors instilled in them to survive. And that those years and thousands of years, hundreds of years of caring and loving them and having that symbiotic relationship was crucial to our survival. When I moved here from Black Mesa, I was profoundly amazed about how much water flowed through this area. When we were planting, and we learned our planting method from when the Hopi people who lived in close proximity to was Black Mesa, being 6,000 feet and higher elevation, we would have all the winter runoff running into our fields. And just like in the spring, our fields would be sitting like 1 or 2 foot of water. And sometimes the monsoons didn't come early or they came late, that's all the water they would have. And sometimes we'd be out there with like buckets and hand watering them, each plant. And when I moved here and started meeting people from the community, I realized how blessed they were and how rich our history was here. And in particular, when you're driving in from Albuquerque, there's a formation called Zitlanoaditli when you're driving almost begin to Napi. In our story, that's where first man and first woman lived. And Navajo Dam, where they dammed up the water, there's a place where Changing Woman, who gave birth to the warrior twins, lived. So always to put it into context for people who aren't from the area, and I'm talking to students from outside the Four Corners, I always tell them that this is kind of like the Garden of Eden, you know?
Wow.
And it's kind of, we're stewards of this area, and it's always been a place of growth and producing food.
And that totally explains the legacy of my ancestors around Chaco Canyon as well, too. And there's that remarkable geologic area, the Bisti Badlands, although they don't know why they call it the Badlands, because it should be the Bisti Goodlands, right? Yeah. But there's just such an amazing ecology and environment. And as you indicated, the San Juan Basin is really at the confluence of these three rivers, and they provide that sustenance, that substance for supporting the communities here.
Yeah. And yeah, going back thousands and thousands of years, communities built around Aztec ruins, salmon ruins. This place was always about providing food. Nowadays, we kind of like transitioned into that, into the, what do you call it, modern agriculture. And I was lucky enough to be raised kind of with that knowledge of using a planting stick and planting by the stars. And that's kind of the knowledge I share. Then when I moved here and I saw how much water and the reason we planted according to the stars and planting sticks, planting deep, was because of the availability of water. And when I started doing research here, I found that, oh, wow, that there's a reason that people chose this area. And this area has always been producing food. And over the course of my research, I found that San Juan County alone, 75% of the water that flows through the state of New Mexico flows through San Juan County. And our ancestors, they didn't have the modern knowledge that we have about the hydrological system, but they had knowledge about growing things and their connection with the earth, connection with the water. And they realized that this place was very, very blessed. And it still continues to be blessed. And being a part of the Agricultural Science Center where I work at is looking to continue that legacy of providing food for people.
Can you describe and share with us the kinds of things that people are doing in the community as far as agriculture?
There's kind of like that dichotomy, like I mentioned before, where there's Western agriculture, which they monocrop and it's very machine heavy. And then on the other hand, you have the indigenous agriculture, which struggles with that. Like, and they want to keep their methods traditional, so to speak, and grow things that are traditional. But at the same time, the biggest export from San Juan County is alfalfa.
Yeah.
And
that's the monocropping.
Yeah. And make money on one hand and then grow what your ancestors grew. And that, it's very hard. And that's the struggle I see every day.
So there's almost like two philosophies there. I mean, Napi and the Navajo. What does Napi stand for?
Navajo Agricultural Products Industry.
Okay. That's one philosophy, which is very industrialized, large production. And then juxtaposition to that are the farmers, as you're saying, who are growing and thinking about how it is that they provide these as substance in healthy ways for their own community.
Yeah. Provide healthy food where they don't have a lot of like fertilizer added. And they have a big, I wouldn't say a fear, but more like a caution toward using pesticides and herbicides, because they don't really have the knowledge of what the impact. But they're very environmentally conscious on the level where they know that things like that, good immediate responses, but like immediate feedback when you input like fertilizer. But the traditional methods are very labor intensive. And that's also another thing that they They want to make money. But on the other hand, there's some people that grow just for their family and just to have traditional food for their family. And so they even I struggle with that as a farmer.
How so?
Do I grow something that people will buy or yeah. make money off?
Right.
Or do I go to the farmer's market where everybody's selling corn, beans, and squash? They're all growing the same thing. And how do I differentiate myself? How do I make my product sell? A lot of times when we go to the farmer's market, like by the end of it, you don't want to take anything home. Because by the end of it, you're just like, oh, you want some? Grandma, you want some? Like, all right. And that's the thing we struggle with is because as a grower, feeding people is sacred. And you can't deny someone who's hungry, and especially if they want traditional food.
Yeah. And what are some of those traditional foods in this region?
If you go to Shiprock, there's a big sign that says the Nashjiji capital of the world, which is like the steamed corn. We make steamed corn back home, but the volume that they do it in the San Juan River Valley is on an industrial scale. Even, I mean, they're not doing it at Nappy. The people who are doing it in the west of Hogback, and you go there September, October, you cannot get an interview with them. You cannot set up any type of visit with them because they are making steamed corn by the truckloads.
Interesting. We have that tradition in my community. We call it hot air.
Yeah.
And we cook it in the ovens or in the earth. Yeah.
And there's some products that are, if your field is adjacent to the road, they make what's called tzidikuo, which is kneel down bread. It's also cooked in the ground traditionally. Farmers, I'm not a business major, but I want to say they know their market. They know their target people that they're going to sell to. And like when I first started working here, this is pre-pandemic and pre-Bull King Minesville, let's say 2015, I would get a 1 ear of corn. I would get it for 25 cents. And now you go to the market, they're $2 each. So if you can imagine, and I'm sure you grow corn, if you can imagine how much a cornfield produces. And
the same with bales of hay.
Yeah.
When I was growing up, it was 50 cents a bale. And now it's $6 a bale.
I'm buying some bales from you if your bales are $6.
Okay. Come on down. So besides corn, what other kinds of food stocks are?
Oh, they squash, melons.
We saw pumpkins.
Yeah, pumpkins. And
how about fruit trees?
This area used to be really big into fruit trees. I always like to catch little tidbits of information. And I glean using a arborist term, or is glean information, is that there's a transit system in Farmington, and it's called the Red Apple. And people always went, why is it called the Red Apple? And I always tell them that there used to be a narrow gauge train that ran from Farmington all the way into Silverton. And what they would transport is apples and fruits, orchards, and everything seemed to be going by the wayside.
Why? What happened?
I would think that it's very labor intensive, like any farming endeavor.
So wage economy kind of uprooted that.
Yeah. There's an orchard in Farmington that's for sale. I wish I had a couple million and I could buy it.
That would keep you occupied.
So if you win the lottery, let me know.
Okay. In our bingo casino in Isleta. So amazing, you know, that in a way the ancestors provided the means and developed the science around being able to provide for their own people. But now there's these two philosophies that essentially are making people kind of think about what is that relationship of food to their communities and their people. And your work, in a sense, kind of exemplifies that and trying to understand how to describe that, right?
Trying to describe it in terms of soil health and in terms of community perceptions about certain technologies and aspects of agriculture. I did write my thesis on that very aspect of what's the perceptions of agriculture in this region in terms of like conservation agriculture, research facilities, research being done. It was very extensive. And so, yeah, just getting the basis of, because I'm, like I mentioned before, I'm not from San Juan County. And we have a saying as Navajos, you can't call someone a friend until you've known them for a year. And I felt that in being Navajo and coming to this community, I felt like an outsider. And then I thought back to my teachings from my grandparents, like, yeah, they want to get to know you. They know if you're going to stick around. And there's a very interesting aspect, because when I first moved here, like we have our clan system, like I mentioned, but the people who live along the river, especially Navajo people, they call themselves Tu'idene, the river people.
Wow.
Which is another, and that just signifies that they've been
relationship,
here,
right?
They understand it, you know, and that's very deep. And then as an outsider, I could, maybe my children will understand that mentality, you know. But me as a indigenous scientist, I often struggle with that. And how do you have an unbiased view of historically rich agricultural community, you know? And I felt that the best way to do it is to get the knowledge from the people, and not get the knowledge, but an understanding of it from the people, and get to live in the situation and be a part of that community.
So an indigenous scientist then is really all about place knowing.
Yeah. Part of it, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Dr. Emerson and I, we used to have late night discussions about this. And because I always struggled with Western science and being a traditionalist. And the best definition we came up with was that as an indigenous scientist, every day you get torn apart by these two philosophies of life. But as an indigenous scientist, your job is to put yourself back together stronger than ever. And then that doesn't imply weakness. It implies that every decision that you make as a researcher and as a scientist, you have to analyze it in terms of how is this going to benefit people and not just you. It's not going to advance your career as an indigenous person. You're trying to move along the five-fingered people, the people who live on the surface, the human people, you know. And that's what you have to think about every day when you make your decisions as a researcher.
That's the same premise of indigenous planning, because we essentially bring together those things that are part of five generations in terms of the planning conceptual model with your Western practices, and be able to bring them together in a way then that builds a better approach to how it is that we think about managing ourselves for the future. So you're basically saying the same thing in terms of how you see yourself in terms of being an indigenous scientist, right?
Yeah. I like that, the Anishinaabe seven generation concept. As the Net people, we try to make decisions, because we always tell people, if you live to 102, that's like, you've been blessed by the holy people, you know. So we always have, in our philosophy, it's make decisions 102 years into the future. Think, plan 102 years into the future.
Yeah. And of course, it all deals with our role and responsibility today, and accepting the fact that what we begin, we may not live long enough to see its completion. But what is it then that's so compelling that our children and our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren will continue that towards its completion?
Exactly.
Yeah. And dealing with this notion of food and the genetics behind it and the science behind it, the ancestors were very much scientists as well, too. They weren't doing things on a random basis.
I always tell people that, like, whenever I give presentations to college students, to high school students, I always tell them that our ancestors were master scientists. And I use this as an example of, like, how many of you love to hike? And a certain amount, raise your hand. And I'll be like, when you go on that hike, how many plants can you name? And I ask, 5, 10. Slowly the arms will start to go, all of them, and pretty soon. How many, then I'm to put it into perspective, I ask them, how many do you think your grandma, your great-grandma knew? And they think about it, and they're like, all of them. They knew the early spring plants, the late spring plants, the early summer plants. They knew which ones were poisonous. They knew which ones were medicine. They knew which ones were good for food, you know. And they were so in tune with their environment that even just getting 1% of that, I'd be happy. And I tell people that they knew the stars. How many of you can name certain constellations? And it baffles me how much my grandpa knew. And I always tell them, your grandparents, they had PhDs in what they were doing, and be proud of that. And for evidence of that knowledge and how sacred it was and the love that they had for things.
So that seems like a Herculean task to try and communicate to young children. And I think as part of the research institute here, you were working with a school on a farm, right? With the youth.
When I first started, I was working on a project called the Yago Healthy Eden and Gardening Project, which was in its second reiteration, which meaning that the first project was a community garden project, which was giving workshops and having a place where the community would go. And the second part of it was developing curriculum for young and the NEST students so they could get familiarity with the gardening and healthy eating. For my part, I shared my traditional ecological knowledge, my indigenous agricultural knowledge, and how those two different knowledge bases met. I wrote my undergrad senior project on how can we attract more people to gardening and agriculture workshops. And my hypothesis was to include that traditional ecological knowledge as well as the modern, like water saving, like agricultural technology. And people will come and they'll stay for the stories, but then they'll leave with the knowledge of the modern, like drip systems and this the stuff that we learned in school that we take for granted. The reason you go to college is you can do something in 30 minutes that will take someone else a week. So, and I always think about that. But the Yago Healthy Eating Gardening Project was, which we're still writing papers on, was a pilot project adding healthy eating curriculum and gardening curriculum, as well as building a school garden for schools to see if its effect on behavior. In terms of making healthy eating choices and knowledge about gardening, we randomly chose three schools in Arizona and three in New Mexico, just to see that if it had any effect. And because like my boss, Dr. Lombard, always says, any work done here has to be hypothesis based, and which is something I think is good. But yeah, we found that due to the communities that were randomly selected to avoid bias, that we gave them a pre-assessment, like the students and parents who agreed to be a part of the project, just to test their knowledge of healthy eating in terms of reading a nutrition label, fruits and vegetables, as well as basic gardening knowledge. And it was a double-blind study to avoid bias. We hired an assessment team to give that assessment. And if me as a person giving the intervention, giving the gardening lessons, the students or parents be like, oh, this is Mr. Francis. I eat 6 to 8 vegetables a day, you know. And just it would skew the results. So the assessment was different. The assessment team was people they didn't know. Then after we did the intervention, as we called the going into the classrooms and giving these lessons, the biggest change was in terms of making healthy eating choices. So having a school garden, having healthy eating curriculum and gardening curriculum is beneficial for students 8 to 10 years old.
Did you find in the study that one of the challenges is the fact that children don't have an extensive palate, that they see food as being strange and therefore then they don't want to eat it?
I would go into the classroom and give my lesson of the day, which either be something about soil, either a milkshake test, which is seen if the breakdown of their soil, whether clay, silt, or sand, and organic matter. But before every day began, I would ask the students, how many of you had breakfast? And maybe less than half would raise their hand. And then other times, I would ask them, I'd bring in like a apple, and I'd ask them, where did this come from? And what do you think they said?
The store.
Exactly. And that's my biggest problem that I saw was that disconnect.
I'm sure they
don't have apple trees at home,
right?
But they could have said an apple tree. They could have said a particular community that grows apples. But instead, they said, "Oh, this came from the grocery store," which was the correct response. I did buy it from the grocery store, but there's that just that immediate disconnect where it didn't come from a tree and it didn't come from the earth.
Yeah, and that's so important in terms of what you said about being a corn saver, right? Mm-hmm. Young people no longer get the chance to go into the field and harvest these and see how it's processed. And just that whole engagement and interaction provides a context for story and meaning. And suddenly then it transforms from just something that you eat to a profound relationship of knowing who it is that you are and what the relationship is to that land. So is that the kind of thing that you teach the children in terms of thinking about this?
My main goal or overarching goal was whenever I talk to students is to teach them that like the daike, which is our term of our growing space, our cornfield, like that was their original classroom for indigenous students who grew corn or grew or who have an agricultural background. From a young age, they learned everything about life, like biology, math class, all mixed into one, as well as instilling discipline and other characteristics into them, which were vital. And along came the boarding school type of education, and it totally disconnected multiple generations away from that knowledge. And I was blessed to have a small part of retaining that knowledge from my grandparents and my parents, but saving that part of it and showing them that we can be self-sufficient, we can be, and through that, we can be resilient.
So speaking about that and conveying these kinds of concepts to the children and getting them to sort of rethink that relationship, what happens when something like the Gold King mind spill came about and totally disrupted everything that was going on in terms of, I guess, the kind of confidence that you have in terms of that nothing is going to change or everything's going to remain the same?
Me and Kevin have been thinking about this a lot due to it's been going to be 10 years next year. And we're always talking about, jokingly, we need to make a movie about it, like our role and what we still remember, you know.
Movie.
And yeah, you can be executive producer, Teddy.
My producer is right here.
Yeah. And I remember because I was part-time here, but I was also working at the Old Fort, which is one of those places where they took kids back in the day to go away from their parents, sometimes in shackles. And a lot of them didn't make it home. And so they wanted to teach kids modern agriculture. That was one of their goals, but it has a tragic history. And in this day, they kind of trying to progress that role of helping young indigenous farmers find a footing in the 21st century. And I was part of that program, and I was also working here. And I remember driving to work and going to check on my plot. And I looked at the river like I usually do. And as a Navajo person, I always pray to the river, and it carries our prayers to the ocean and up into the sky and back to us, and the blessings come back to us. And I noticed it was an off color. And sometimes animus is especially in the rainy season, it's a brown color.
Right.
But this was orange. And I had to stop and take a picture. And immediately I sent it to Dr. Lombard, who was in Louisiana at the time. And I was like, oh, this can't be natural. And then I went on to my plot. And I kept thinking about it. It was one of those things where you can feel your life changing. And I can hearken it to, like, Not to belittle these things I'm talking about, but to your child being born, to a successful thesis defense, you know that things aren't going to be the same. When I got back down here, everyone was in a mad scramble. Every farmer was in a mad scramble, and it was chaos. everyone was surprised, and it was a wake-up call.
When you say people were in a mad scramble, obviously, because it's so complex here with regards to the relationships of just understanding that natural ecology, but there was bureaucracies and politics and jurisdictions involved in this, and trying to react immediately to what do we do? What was that mad scramble about?
The mad scramble, like you mentioned, was just a lack of communications between communities. I know we like to throw around the term, think like a watershed, but in that time, in that era, everyone had their own separate little enclaves. The type of agriculture being done here is very different than the Animas Valley up in Durango and those communities. And I'm sure it's very different in Aneth as well. But there was just nobody was talking with each other and letting each, like, I woke up, I didn't even know that that happened. And I think the word was that the plume, as the heavy metal plume, was moving at 2.5 miles per hour, if you can imagine. Wow. And you could walk beside it. You could outwalk it, so to speak. And no one let anybody know. So the mad scramble was to close all those head gates. And then after it went through, how long did we keep these head gates closed?
It gave that new sense of urgency of trying to know that something was being situated, which hadn't been an issue before, right?
Yeah. And I always use this as an example. There was a man, he was bitten by a shark, and that shark saved his life. Because if he hadn't been bitten, he wouldn't have known that he had a condition, though curable, that could have been fatal. And that's the analogy I use when I describe the Gold King Mine spill. Like, now we know. And it could have been worse. It's happened before. It can happen again. But now we live in an age where we have an ability to tell people about it in our pocket. And we're more aware of the situation. And I think it's made us a better community in terms of helping each other, in terms of water issues.
So in a way, it kind of broke that isolation and basically gave a bit much broader perspective of we're in this together.
Yeah, yeah. From my perspective, I know farmers in Colorado, and I know farmers in the San Juan River Valley. And I started my farming in Colorado. I'm my modern farm, modern agricultural farming, I like to say, in Colorado. And these communities actually letting each other know that we're all in the same boat, so to speak.
So what did they talk about?
Like, sometimes you'll get an alert on your phone if you're part of that network of farmers and that community.
Wow, so it escalated into that kind of technology.
So there's been events where, like a rainy event, and that turbidity stirs up the water, and they'll be like, close your head gates, and they'll send messages along that system.
So that's the innovation aspect of it.
And yeah, so there all this research that hadn't been done before, because we always like to say this is a research black hole, the four corners. Like for us, for example, we're in MSU, and our main base is in Las Cruces.
And when I first started working, 7 hours away from here, right?
Yeah. And a guy who used to work here, when I first started working here, he gave me that talk where he's like, it's like working on the moon. You know, you can tell them what you're going to do, but you have to make the decisions in real time, you know? Like, I like to say there was no game plan of what to do in that type of situation. But the right thing to do would to be get samples. And hindsight, it's better to have that data, like go out and get those samples. And a lot of times that was the rush of everybody was, how do we document this? Over the course of, like you mentioned, the spill, it opened up a wider understanding that had been forgotten. There was even a bigger spill in like 1979 when Lake Emma collapsed. And I think it turned the river like a silver aluminum color.
I don't know that. incident. What was that? Where was it?
It was up in the same watershed, the Animas River watershed, and it turned the river like a silver color. The Animas River used to be a dead river. Even nowadays, and you can say Brendan Francis told you this, but you're only allowed to eat one fish from that river. And with that knowledge, would you still eat that one fish?
Even today?
Yeah.
So when you say the Animas was a dead river, is it still a dead river?
Due to all the mining that was done in the 1800s, they have gold star fishing in Durango. But before all this conservation work, before CERCLA and before the Environmental Protection Act passed by Richard Nixon, there was so much legacy mining that was just left open. Very similar to the uranium situation on the Navajo Reservation. And CERCLA, they only fixed the top biggest contaminated, possibly dangerous sites. So there's over, like, my best guess, 300 mines in similar condition or tailings ponds in similar condition. And situations like that could happen. And they're allowed legally to release hundreds of gallons of heavy metal laden water into the system. It's just that day, due to the Gold King mine spill, 4.5 million gallons was a tipping point where we said, oh, there's something wrong with that river. But what we didn't know was that it's already occurring process.
It was already messed up to begin with.
Yeah, and people became aware. And there's a limit of how much, like, heavy metals are allowed into the river. And it was a wake-up call. And it's not saying that the mining caused the heavy metal. It's just that the La Plata Mountains used to be an ancient caldera that collapsed in on itself. And so when that process happened, all the precious metals were near the surface. So even when the Spanish came into the region, they were like, how come the indigenous people aren't mining all this? And they didn't know about the sacred pacts that we had with the earth and different things, but they realized that, oh, there's going to be a lot of precious metals that can be mined here. And so that process, the heavy metal process, leaking into the river was already a naturally occurring thing, but it was exacerbated by the type of mining they did in the 1800s and the lack of remediation from those effort from that work.
Wow, I was totally unaware of that. So we're not talking about a pristine environment that it was already impacted, but this essentially created an urgency because people could actually see it.
Yeah.
As opposed to it being kind of invisible.
Those newspaper articles from the early 1900s of the farmers living in the Animas River Valley in Durango complaining about the river. They were like, the river ran black, you can imagine. And they were like, this is not sustainable.
And these areas are the breadbasket for lots of produce all over the country, right?
Yeah. And like I mentioned, Farmington, its name implies farming.
Right.
Bloomfield, Flora Vista, you know, they named these because of the level of productivity the land could produce. And all that food, like I mentioned, the red apple, it was providing the food for those miners. And in turn, they didn't realize that, oh, maybe we live in an interconnected system where we should be thinking about what we're doing. But hindsight is 20/20. And luckily nowadays, as humans, we're trying to heal those wounds.
Yeah. So this whole kind of transformation really has been bringing this kind of awareness and knowledge to this place in a way that people had ignored or simply not realized that this was what was going on.
That's the ideal statement. It's been going on. And it's just events like that, like the Gold King Mine spill, were happening for years. It's just that we didn't realize that in the 21st century that things like this could happen. And that same year, there was also another major similar event in Brazil. A dam broke, holding back heavy metal laden water. So that was like a big year for acid mine drainage work, you know. Bringing awareness to the subject was key, and learning the limits of our system was key. And as humans, we always like to push the limits of our systems. We see our car, and like, oh, the e-light just came on, you know? Oh, I know my car. I know how far we can go, you know? Going back to sampling, everyone collected samples in the beginning, but then there's certain protocol where a lab will actually hold it viable. There's certain containers you have to put the water in. There's certain way you're supposed to collect the samples. And so all that, if it's going to stand up in a peer-reviewed paper or stand up in, as Kevin always tells me, if it's going to stand up in court, you know. And as scientists, we hold ourselves to a high standard. We want to share that knowledge with the community and have them have that sense of where they can be advocates for their communities. So teaching them like the proper way to collect a sample, the proper way to store a sample, and things like that. And in that way, we built trust with the community. And like I said, I'm a relatively newcomer to this community, and the Science Center, or the NMSU Ag Science Center of Farmington, has that, I believe, that good standing with the community, where if they need something, especially if they need something, like if they're worried about something in their soil, we offer them that free testing for heavy metals. And that came from the Gold King mine spill. So answering the needs of your community is very important in terms of sharing scientific knowledge and being transparent with that knowledge.
So going back a little bit in terms of your foundation of having that relationship to your own people, your mother, your grandparents, the ancestral knowledge, you being the keeper of that information as it was practiced, and then seeing this mess that has now occurred, that is the wake-up call, as we've kind of described it. What role does Indigenous knowledge play in terms of helping to rectify this?
One thing I always try to explain to people, and because not all of us have that level of education, is the Western knowledge tries to divide things into the hydrosphere, the geosphere, and what I always like to say is, as Indigenous people, it's good to define them and see them as separate, but we see it as a whole. And when events like that happen, it just shows you that part of our system is broken and it needs to be healed, and it's possible. And it takes a community talking together and working together. And the response after the spill was one of those things where people came together, not just Indigenous people, but farmers from various communities. And they saw that then their responses were all different. Some of them were, let's open up the headgates right now, you know, and then other people, other communities, right, let's wait. Trying to bridge those different viewpoints is kind of, I see our role as a science center is showing all the viewpoints, even though we live in the same community, that we all have the same overarching goal, which is feeding people and continuing that long history of agriculture, which is, I would say, sacred. And
so I know Navajo has a really important concept around hojo, balance. Is that part of that?
Oh, yeah. In our perspective, and there's two forces and constant conflict, I would say, in our universal view of things. One is perfection, and the other is rune, hachwon. And our way of life is finding a path in between those two conflicting things, because even in perfection, I want everything so good, you know. And on this side, there's total ruin and I wouldn't say chaos, but destructive aspect of it. And but as a Dene person, finding that balance and striking that balance is key. Is key.
So would you say that farming is a manifestation of that balance?
In my life, I always tell people every day is the best day of my life because I get to plant, I get to grow things, I go to work, I get to help people and do research on growing things. And I even dream about farming and growing things. And I'm very blessed to have this opportunity to do this. And I take it really seriously, like, because it's not only like a job. Like I mentioned, I view myself as a corn planter, which is something very sacred. Planting and growing things and continuing being a part of that cycle, it centers me, it's healing, it's all these things that almost indescribable, you know.
So it's almost a life in balance you, right?
Yeah.
And you're hoping that others will be able to reclaim that for themselves as well too.
I hope they can reclaim it in their own way. And an artist once told me, who was also a farmer, and he said, if you want people to emulate you, make it beautiful, provide beauty into it. And I think about that every day, like, because as scientists, we think of them as two separate things, but as indigenous people, your art should magnify your scientific aspect of your life. And in the same way, you know, your science should elevate your art, you know?
And yeah, it goes back to some of my own teachings with my grandfather and thinking about how he cultivated the fields. There was an aesthetic there. It wasn't just enough to do the doing, but it was doing it a certain way that exuded this notion of being proud and of everything being done in an exceptional way. It was like sort of going back to some of your ways of thinking about describing things as, wow, look at this functional thing, but it's a beautiful car. It's got a beauty attached to it as opposed to just being utilitarian. And it's almost the same way that he treated his fields as well as the other old people in the community. It was like, it wasn't enough just to farm, but there was a whole beauty behind it.
Yeah. Yeah. I often, when I think about my youth, I often think about the way my grandparents or parents planted. And I always think that there was almost, it was almost an art form. And it started from when they were very young. Their love was instilled in it. And you could tell they put their soul, so to speak, into it.
Well, it was just like when Kevin was showing us in that big warehouse back there. I believe he had a couple of your big blue squashes there. What is it? The Hubbard squash?
Yeah.
They're beautiful, right?
I only provided the seeds for those. They were for a grad student, Emiliana McLean's agrovoltaics project, to see if we could grow traditional crops under a photovoltaic system. But yeah, they can get massive. And I always tell people, like, the way our ancestors planted was each of these plants by themselves, they'll do fine. But like us, when we have friends and family around, we excel. So when we grow in diversified systems, we're having these plants be a part of a community. And I saw that. When you extract something, like when you exclude something from the environment and say, oh, this is just for me. You know, it's like, it's not the way to be. It's for everybody.
But, you know, taking that aesthetic and thinking about our own ancestors, a corn is just not a corn. It's got colors and it's associated with our clans and it's associated with our understanding of the cosmos and the directions and our histories of migration. So my clan is associated with black corn.
Amazing.
So that's the aesthetic we're also bringing to our lives.
I like how you brought up black corn because my grandma, she always taught me in our corn pollen pouches, she always said, you're supposed to keep a blue corn, a black corn, and a yellow corn, and a white corn in there for our sacred directions. And no one grew black corn for a long time. And when I was gifted some seed and I gave it to her, she cradled it like a baby, like a long lost relative. And I just, and then just thinking about it, I was like, that's our connection with corn, is it's our relative. And you put it in, I couldn't have said it better.
You know, it also reminds us of our matrilineal connections and how those are passed on and how we inherit those. And in my society, everybody is born into a particular clan and associated with a particular color. But my society socially engineered a way so that if somehow a young person is adopted in who may come from another community or whatever and has to be associated with a particular clan, but that matrilineal connection is not clear, then they go into the middle one, which is the mixture of all of these colors.
Mm. That's very beautiful.
Yeah. But I mean, that's the kind of thinking. The ancestors were thinking in the cosmos and the philosophy of all of this. It was just not to feed your belly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that.
So any last things that you would like to?
I always share this story. Students, when I have them, I like to play like participation when I'm giving presentations. Like, who can name all the sacred corn colors? And then, of course, they name all the colors. And then they always mention red corn. And they're like, what does red corn symbolize? And I always tell them the story. And it's ideal for this story because when I first got into research, and you have to go through the Navajo Nation Human Research Review Board and IRB Board for our sovereign nation, all research done on the reservation and on Indigenous people. So you go to this meeting, and it's so scary. You're sitting with the top scientists on the Navajo Nation, and they've been selected to wean out or not wean out, and that's the wrong word, to enrich the research being done. But as a young researcher, I used to be petrified of these meetings. And I'm like, man, they're going to, because you see some people, they get slammed so bad at these meetings. And it's not that they're not doing bad work. It's just the way they're going about it, that there's a process and it has to be respected, because there's been data extraction in the past, just like resource extraction. And it's never been, we've never been on the winning side of it till very recently. And I used to sit in these meetings, and like any meeting where there's a board, they have to have quorum. So I'm sitting in a room waiting for the board to come in, and other researchers are there. When pre-COVID, this is pre-COVID. Now all the meetings are on Zoom. And this is when I found out that Hatkathis, or medicine men, were also doing research, are also scientists. And this was amazing to me. And this medicine man told me this story as he was waiting. He was saying that he told me a story of why we plant red corn and why we should honor sacred pacts that our ancestors made. And like I mentioned about Navajo Dam, and I always say the name wrong. It's like Gober Nauber Knob. That's where Changing Woman lived, where San Nadlehe. And she gave birth to the warrior twins. And this was a time of turmoil on the earth, because a lot of cultures across the world have stories of yetis or giants that plague the earth, you know, and were causing all sorts of chaos and ruin across it. And some of them were even, I don't know if you can add this in your story, but were children eaters, you know. And one day, Change Woman gave birth to twins and was raising them in this world, and she'd have to hide her children every time the we call them monsters sometimes, but we call them giants, would come around looking for them, and she would hide them and pretend like, oh, I want children, these are their steps, you know, and And then, because I did, as that growing, they grew up in this world and they wanted to change it, as anyone would. But they also wanted to find out who their father was. So they went on this long quest, and it probably take me hours to tell the story. Eventually, they found out that their father was a son, or Jonah, and they went to him. Over the course of the story, he put them through trials, very similar. You mentioned Hercules, these trials to assure that these were his kids. And they survived through the various help from the holy people and the animals. And finally, he agreed, oh, you're my children. And I always tell this joke. If you know a Navajo and if you ask him or you need something from him, ask him four times and he'll have to give it to you. Because it's written in our DNA. I'm sure most indigenous people, four is like a sacred number.
Yeah.
And and finally he relented and he was like, they're like, we need weapons and knowledge to rid the world of these giants. We're causing ruin. And he asked and asked and asked. And finally he relented and he was like, I'll agree if you tell me why. And he explained, like, the reason I said no the first three times was those giants, those monsters you're explaining are also my children. Everything, all of you are my children, you know? And if you go back into like planetismal hypothesis, we all are made of the same atoms, you know? So he agreed, but he also told them that, made them promise that they would not become the new evil on the earth with the weapons and knowledge that he gave him. And in honor of that pact that we made in time immemorial, was we'd always plant red corn. But then they went about their process of fighting and slaying those yetis and monsters who became sometimes like mountains, hilltops, geological features. But them being immortal, they always came back. So just like any type of warfare, it was an endless cycle of violence. And it was unending. And the warrior twins, they'd have to have what I think this is the origin of one of our ceremonies from when our warriors come back from war to heal them from all the trauma. It's one of the origins of that. But also the monsters or giants, they got tired of being killed over and over again. And so they made a pact with each other. They said, we'll stay in the earth. You as had to tell the people that you're doing this for, the five-fingered people, the surface dwellers, you cannot dig in the earth. We'll stay in the earth. So every time we planted with a planting stick, purposeful and with prayer and song. And when we buried people, we didn't bury them in the ground. We buried them tied them up in a tree. We covered them with rocks to honor that pact. It was that wise Atkatli, our medicine man's belief that we broke that pact when we went after uranium, when we went after oil, when we went after coal. And that's just something to think about.
Wow. Okay. What an amazing relationship story to relate. Thank you very much. This was just absolutely indescribable. And I'm just so happy that we're going to be able to share some of this with people because they're hungry for understanding what role does indigenous knowledge play in all of this. And even within the Transformation Network, that was one of the things that they were asking, how can indigenous communities help inform the kind of science that's going on? So I think you covered many of those points. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Ted. It's been an honor.